Les conférences du Collège de France.
So Steve Quake is an invited professor at the Collège de France. Edith Heard, Hugues de Thiers, and myself have been hosting him. It's a true honor and pleasure to host him. Steve gave two lectures back in June, and he wanted to give a little pause, maybe to give more thinking. And so he's coming after a summer to continue to share his thoughts on the mysteries of the cell, which I think is a great title because it's very open. It's a mystery, so we have never ended with the job of actually trying to understand what happens in the cell. And I want to say a few things. I mean, you know Steve Quake because, for one hand, he's a famous scientist, but also because he was introduced and he gave his lectures before in the summer. I want to say two things. He's one of the ever-increasing number of physicists who came to biology. In my experience, these people have been the ones who have been the most inspiring. And so I want to thank him for having been brave enough to move from biology to physics to biology. And he does it in a way which I think is very rich, because on one hand, he has contributed conceptually to the field of biology. He also contributed technologically by developing new tools which have been important for basic biology in the field of omics on one hand, and also for medicine. His lectures actually span the whole range of the applications as well as the conceptual efforts to think about biological systems in new ways. So thank you, Steve, for coming. And today we'll be listening to you regarding the topics of immunology, but I think your views on evolution in the immune repertoire will have a broader impact for us to think about what is so specific of biological systems. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Thomas. It's wonderful to be back here at Collège de France. Today, we are going to talk about a fascinating and important part of the body, the immune system. It's incredibly complex, and I'm not going to do it justice. We're going to zero in on one particular aspect and even just one cell type within the immune system, but a very important one from the perspective of evolution. So if Darwin were alive today, I think he would be very interested in the immune system because it is a beautiful example of natural selection. In every day, all of our bodies, every day, there's millions of such experiments going on. And the winners of those evolutionary experiments are the ones that get to protect us from disease. And the timescales are amazing. I mean, what takes traits to evolve in humans take tens of thousands of years. And our immune system happens in a matter of weeks. And there's some really just amazing questions about how the immune system works, especially the so-called adaptive immune system. And how does it protect us against diverse pathogens? There's only 20,000 genes in the human genome, but there's many more pathogens out there that we're exposed to and the immune system protects us from. There's synthetic chemicals that have never been seen before that our body can still make antibodies against. And one of the central mysteries of immunology was, how does that happen? And I'm going to sum up about a century of history very quickly to kind of address that point. So back in the turn of the 20th century, Paul Ehrlich had noticed that antibodies get produced when cells and animals are exposed to toxins. And he had a theory that there were preformed receptors there. He had sort of called the side chain theory, and he called them antibodies. That notion was wrong, this idea that everything was preformed. But the notion of antibodies as sort of locks waiting for keys and being involved in that ended up being very important. And as sort of a further sort of demonstration that, you know, the system hasn't been trained against everything in advance, Karl Landsteiner showed in the 30s that animals could make antibodies against synthetic chemicals that had never existed before. So there's no way that could have been programmed in the genome. And how that came about was sort of a mystery that puzzled people for decades. And the conceptual breakthrough came in the 1950s when Bernay articulated his theory of clonal selection. He said, well, maybe the immune system is like a miniature evolution experiment, and the key thing that's doing the evolving happens within a cell. It's not that the molecules are evolving on their own. It's that the cells are doing it, and they grow clonally, just like bacteria do. And then selection chooses the winners and the successful antibodies. And it's sort of survival by the fittest at the cellular level. And that, in his broad strokes, was correct. But the details and the biological mechanism for that took several more decades to unravel. And even today, I don't think we fully understand all of it. But in important aspects, we do. And one of the most important discoveries was that by Susumu Tanigawa, who figured out that, in fact, the B cells will shuffle their genomes. And they do combinatoric experiments with gene fragments in order to create a huge diversity of antibodies. And it's like having a little genetic slot machine in every B cell. And I'm going to talk more about that in detail because it'll be important for what we discuss. I mentioned something about the speed of evolution in the immune system. This is data from the 60s showing over the course of weeks, antibodies improving their affinity. So smaller numbers are better, better binders. And you can see that in the scale of weeks here, they're improving dramatically by orders of magnitude and making very good binders. This is sort of the famous line from Burnett's paper, concept of population genetics applied to clones of cells within the body. So what are these antibodies? Let's talk about the structure of the molecules. They have this sort of famous Y shape. And the part that binds the antigens are the ends here. They're symmetric around this axis. So this half are the same. And this is the part that gets evolution axon to find a shape that matches the shape of the antigens. And here you see antigen binding here. This is the sort of conceptual shape here. The bigger piece is called the heavy chain. The smaller piece is called the light chain. I'm going to focus on the heavy chain for the majority of today's lecture. This bit down here, it's called the constant region or the effector region, and it'll come up later in the talk. The thing to take away is the Y shape, the ends here where all the variation happens and where the antigens bind. And this is what sort of Tanigawa worked out, how that's done. It turns out that there are several little gene fragments that get recombined. For the so-called antibody gene or B cell receptor, there's three different flavors, Vs, Ds, and Js. And what happens inside of each B cell is that the genome is cut and pasted in this region. One V and one D and one J are sort of randomly chosen and glued together. And that creates a potential antibody. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because the gluing, cutting and gluing is not perfect. And some sequence can be cut away or inserted randomly in the junctions between the V and the D and the D and the J, and that increases sort of the combinatorics of it a bit. But this is like sort of the birth of an antibody here, and there's a certain amount of diversity, which we'll talk about in a moment, in the combinatorics. Now, the next thing that can happen is hypermutation. So the cell has an enzyme that will go through and do point mutations randomly throughout the gene. And so it'll make random changes and do experiments to try to improve the antibody binding properties. This part of the gene right here, we'll talk about a little later, which has to do with the constant region and the class of the antibody. But this sort of process is sort of amazing and unprecedented in our bodies in a lot of ways. The idea that a cell will reprogram its own genome to create random diversity. And you can ask, how many are there? All right, we're physicists, we want to be quantitative. Let's just start with how many antibodies are there. And if you look back in the literature, estimates were all over the place. Barrick and Milstein had made an estimate of 10 to the 10th. You're limited in your body. You can't have more antibodies than you have B cells. And so the number of B cells provides some kind of upper limit for how many you have at any given time. How many of the antibodies are useful? What's useful after the selection? I mean, Cohn was estimating a much smaller number. And so there was sort of a general question of the frequency and multiplicity and distribution of antibody frequencies. And so we decided to take this project on in my lab some years ago using the power of next generation sequencing, which I've talked about in the previous lectures. And we thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could sequence all the antibodies in one individual? Or something approaching that. And this was the work of Jenny Jiang, Josh Weinstein, and Daniel Fisher, a collaborator. So if you look at the textbooks, these are sort of the estimates. And let's focus on human for a minute. So 65 Vs, 27 Ds, 6 Js. You can multiply that all together. You get order of 10 to the fourth. And that doesn't include the junctional diversity. If you do that, you get a couple more orders of magnitude. You include the light chain, the mutation. Now you're up to really staggeringly large numbers of potential antibodies, which, of course, in your body, you're again limited by the number of B cells because each B cell can only make one because it's reprogrammed its genome to do that. So that's Most you could have theoretically in practice, but of course, because there's the cells are dividing and you have not just a single cell, it's order of magnitude less distinct antibodies at any given time. This number was too great to imagine sequencing all at once. And moreover, I don't know how you get them all from a human. We couldn't get the whole body and all the B cells. And so we decided to work with a model organism to start with. And we chose zebrafish. And I'll talk a bit about its immune system in a minute. But one very nice property of the zebrafish is there's only about 100,000 B cells. So you could conceive of measuring all of them, the sequences of every antibody that a fish makes. But how useful is a fish immune system, and what would it teach us about humans? It turns out fish are an amazing model system for immunology. The adaptive immune system, as we understand it, as I just explained, first evolved when fish got jaws. That's the moment in the history of life on Earth when they began eating things that required them to be able to distinguish self from non-self and perhaps fight off pathogens more than they did before. And so if you go back 400 million years, shark has an adaptive immune system, zebrafish shortly thereafter. And if you look at the way zebrafish makes its antibodies, it has all the same mechanistic biochemistry that humans do, and which I just described for you. It has VDJ recombination, it has that junctional diversity, that little sequence randomization when you glue them together, and it's got somatic hypermutation. And so it's like a miniature version of what we'd want to understand in humans. So we started with that, and because we could look at the entire fish, we could grind up the whole fish, look at every antibody, no matter where the B cells were in whatever tissue, we figured out how to prepare the RNA, amplify it. We sequenced it on one of the early next generation sequencers, and then got to do a lot of computation on those sequences. And that was an interesting challenge all on its own, how to put them together, figure out which ones came from the same antibody, what were the same clonal lineages, what were sequencing errors and PCR errors. And from that, we could calculate all sorts of quantitative properties about the immune system that nobody had ever been able to do before, because we were taking a holistic look. So I'm going to just give you a couple of sort of tastes of what we learned from doing that. The first thing is you might imagine that the immune systems are very similar between different individual fish. That's because they share common genetics. These were not fish from the wild. These were fish raised in tanks in a controlled environment. Same tanks, same water, preserved from pathogens. They're protected from pathogens, same food. But however, the VDJ-omes were wildly different. And so each of these is a different fish. This is the V-axis, the D-axis, and the J-axis. So each point in the three-dimensional space is one VDJ combination. And the size of the ball there is the number of antibodies that had that VDJ combination. And you can see that these look nothing alike, which was very surprising to us. And so we thought a lot about that and began to look for what were some shared properties. And so rather than look at the individual VDJs, we began to look at frequency distributions and things like that. And sure enough, we began to find some universal shared properties. So all the fish, even though the individual choices of VDJs were different in their weighting, the overall distribution of usage, the frequency distributions, followed a common law. And the same was true for antibodies, by the way. If you looked at antibody frequency distribution, you also found a shared law. And so there were some common statistical properties shared across all fish, even though at first glance, each immune system seemed to be molecularly quite different between individuals. And we decided to try to answer the question I started at the beginning, how many antibodies are there in the fish? And this estimate is based on the heavy chains, not the light chains, but it provides a bound for that. And through different individual fish and different sort of ways to calculate sort of upper and lower bounds, we estimated, you know, a few thousand heavy chains. So a few thousand, probably 10,000, if you factor in the light chain distribution, antibodies per individual fish. And that puts sort of a cap on it in an interesting way. Now, to give you a sense for what these measurements meant for the field and what was changing by bringing sequencing to the table here, this, when we published the paper, or just before we published the paper, this is a sort of cumulative distribution of all antibodies ever sequenced by the entire scientific community. And so this is orders, units of 10 to the fourth, starts in the early 90s. And you had human, mouse, other. Nobody was really working on zebrafish. They weren't there. Now, our single paper contributed many, many more sequences than had ever been sequenced before. So you get an idea of sort of just the sheer amount of quantitative sequence data you can think about and getting this sort of holistic picture of the way antibodies are made that wasn't possible before. So that was great news if you're a zebrafish, and probably we can do a lot to help the health and well-being of zebrafish, but of course we're interested in humans too. And I'm going to sort of skip over a lot of technical details, but just to say that we invested many years figuring out how to do the same thing with humans. We didn't grind them up in a blender. We used blood samples, so we were subsampling the immune system. And as sequencing methods got more powerful, we were able to sequence more deeply with more precision and so forth. I'll give you a couple of examples of things that we've looked at in the human immune system and learned from these sorts of measurements. And this was the work by Felix Horns and Chris Vollmers when they were in my group. There's sort of two little vignettes here. One is going to be this question about class switch decisions, so the different isotypes. We'll talk about that again for a minute. And then the other is trying to measure the strength of natural selection. So coming back to this question of evolution, if selection is going on, and some antibodies are selected for, others are not, can we sort of quantitatively measure strength of selection on a per antibody, per lineage basis using all this massive amount of data? And so we began to develop algorithms to reconstruct not just the relationships between antibodies, but their actual lineage history. And so we get a bunch of different sequences that all share the same VDJ, but also share the same junctional diversity. So they're clearly all descendants of the same recombination event that created an early antibody. That would happen here. And then as there's mutations, in that gene, we can measure the number of mutations and the relationships between the various descendants of that original cell. And we can also measure the class switching, which is denoted by colors here, and I'll get back to that in a moment. And we don't see every single member of the lineage, but we do see a subset, and from that we can sort of reconstruct a history and know something about the ancestry of these antibodies. And also the number of mutations gives us something equivalent to a clock, so we learn something about time as well. So if you do that for a blood sample from a human being, you get something that looks like this. It's a lot of different antibody lineages. And each one of these you can kind of zoom in on like this, okay? See the relationships between descendants from the same recombination event and sort of number of mutations shown here. So now let me return to this question of class switching and classes, because that's what these colors are. So there's basically in humans five different kinds of antibodies. And they sort of begin their lives as IgM. This is before there's been hypermutation for the most part. And when the first recombination event happens, IgD also shows up in that role a little bit. Then they can switch to a different type of antibody called IgG, which is like the main thing for a response in the blood, or IgA, which is the main thing for response in mucus, also in breast milk. Or they can go to IgE, which is originally there to help fight parasites like worms, but also ends up being a source of allergic responses. And how does it do the switching? What does that mean? Okay, remember I told you this is the variable part, this is the constant part here. This is the last part of the gene editing or gene cutting that the cells do. They can swap out the sequences for these constant parts. So they start as M or D, and then through the same kind of cutting and pasting of the genome, they can cut out parts of the constant region and then move the other ones over that become the front of the antibody. So the red ones are IgG, somewhere in here, this orange is IgE, and blue is IgA. Through that, this region down here gets swapped out with different sequences. And those are the different classes or isotypes of the antibodies. And the sequence there helps determine the function of the role, where the antibody goes, whether it's in the mucus, whether it's interacting with different cells of the immune system, and so forth. Because of the order of these things and you're cutting the DNA out, there's kind of a limited set of paths or trajectories that the cells can go through. The M and the D are first, so that's where things start. Once they're cut out and you've gone to something like IgG, you can never go back to M because that piece of the genome has been cut out and it's gone. But when you're IgG, you can switch to IgE because you can cut out these parts and keep the orange part. And if you're IgE, you can get to IgA. So that ends up being sort of interesting and helpful in reconstructing these lineages. And so now you can see the colors here. And at the center of each of these is a gray circle, which is IgM. That's where they started, first recombination. And then as the mutations happen, sometimes there's class switching to one color in this direction, different color in this one. You can see it moving in different ways here between red and blue and such forth. And we've been able to measure all that information. And sort of for the first time, we're able to work out the rates at which B cells like to switch how they go from one isotype to another and sort of map that out with actual rate constants and numbers for the first time. And this sort of shows from IgM to the different kinds of IgG to IgA and such forth. And in doing so, we stumbled across something sort of interesting, which remains a mystery to this day, which is that the switching is not uncorrelated. So if you have sort of the founder cell, it divides, creates children, they create children. At some point, each of these different lineages makes a decision to class switch, and you'd think it would be random. So when this lineage switches, it doesn't have to be the same as when this one does. But it turns out they're highly correlated for reasons that are still a mystery. And that's what this data shows. So each of these graphs is the same thing. It's just it's measuring sort of a statistic about the correlation of class switching as a function of time, as measured by mutations from the common progenitor. And these are different class switches. So each one of these different class switches. And the black lines show the actual data. And you can see that they're highly correlated and when they switch. And it becomes less correlated over time, sort of the more farther away you get from the common progenitor. The red shows shuffle data. And so if you randomize the data, you see it's a much different distribution, and it looks uncorrelated in that way. Why this happens, we have a bunch of ideas. There's another molecular mechanism waiting to be discovered there. And with that in mind, let's turn to the other question that Felix and Chris looked at, which is trying to measure strength of selection. And so in this case, we were able to do experiments on humans, and we could perturb their immune system by giving them a vaccine. And so we wanted to see what happened when they were given flu vaccine. And we took blood for a couple of days from each individual, a couple of days before the vaccine was given, and then for a week and a half afterwards, we drew blood every couple of days. And we were wondering if we could figure out which lineages were responding in response to the vaccine and see if they were under selection pressure or not. And so, again, to sort of cut to the chase here, it sort of became evident that, broadly speaking, there were two types of lineages in these people. And so this is now time before to after the vaccine, and this is now sort of the lineage's fraction of the repertoire, how strong that lineage is and what portion of the repertoire it represents. And each line here is a different lineage. There was one type of lineage that kind of blew up after the vaccine was given. About a week afterwards, all of a sudden, these lineages became very highly represented, just kind of like Ehrlich's experiments, except here with RNA. Other lineages remained unchanged from before to after the vaccine. And so we call these persistent. We call these vaccine responsive. Now, we wanted to see, were there any molecular differences in the lineages, like in the mutations and in the way that they sort of presented themselves? And so let me take a step back and talk about population genetics here and sort of what you'd expect to happen if there was selection. If mutations were random and there was no selection, you'd expect to see just sort of a lot of rare mutations, very few common ones. If, however, there was selection, so imagine here, each of these is a different genome of a person or a bacterium or something. And the red is a mutation here that provides a selective advantage. Maybe it's antibiotic resistance for bacteria. What you'd expect to happen is that this one would grow and become a much larger portion of the population. So if a so-called selective sweep happened, you'd see that thing highly overrepresented, like in almost every individual. And so if you were to plot a histogram of density of mutations as a function of the frequency of the mutation, when there's selection going on, you'd expect to see a few mutations being very highly represented in almost everything. Whereas with random mutations, it would just fall off monotonically. Okay, and so Richard Nayer and Boris Halichuk kind of formalized this as a mathematical argument and worked out a way to kind of measure strength of selection by looking at this distribution, in particular what's happening here at the very highly frequent end of mutation frequencies and what their density is. And so this would be this would be organism under strong selection, these would be neutral drift, no selection. And so we decided to calculate this sort of histogram for our antibody lineages in our humans. And these are the results for the vaccine responsive lineages. And you can see everything falls down, but then they turn around here and they start to peak up. The green line is the theoretical calculation before, the brown line is the other ones. That's neutral prediction, that's selection prediction. And you can see the actual individuals from different lineages across different people. The net vaccine response lineages are turning up here like you'd expect if there was strength in selection. How about the persistent lineages that didn't change under vaccination? Those don't turn around as you get to high frequency. They just keep falling, consistent with what you'd expect from neutral drift. And so we think about a quarter of the repertoire is evolving neutrally, and you know, we have some ideas of what subtypes of B cells they might be, but have been able to sort of really quantitatively measure strength of selection in response to specific perturbations in the immune system using only the gene expression data. And if you sort of summarize the histogram data and just look at the relative power sitting in that 90% and higher abundance levels, these are the vaccine responsive, these are the persistent. It's a very clear quantitative difference, and it's pretty obvious which ones are under strong selection, the ones that are being made in response to the flu vaccine. Okay, let me turn to another topic in evolution and see how we can connect it to the immune system. There's this amazing phenomenon of convergent evolution, which has happened over and over again among animals in our world. And nature seems to find the same solution more than once and in different ways. And some classic examples of it are echolocation, which has evolved both in dolphins and bats, but is not shared by any common ancestor. So they both got at it independently. Wings have evolved multiple times. Bats again, birds, pterosaurs, again without a common ancestor that shares the wings. Another one that I personally love is the box camera eye. So sort of the physics of how the eye works. Humans, we have a box camera eye. So do some octopuses. But there's many other ones in between. And so again, nature got to the box camera construction kind of more than once. And you know, in all our work looking at antibodies, we asked, how many times do two humans evolve exactly the same antibody and share exactly the same sequence? That was very rare, but there's a special case where it happens surprisingly often, and that's in the case of food allergies. And so we have spent a lot of time trying to understand what's going on in food allergies. The immune system is responding inappropriately in this case, is making antibodies, but not against something that's threatening you, and it can be a very dangerous sort of response. There are, you know, roughly 8 to 10% of the population suffers from food allergies. That's uniform all over the world. The numbers aren't that different. They've been increasing over time. Food allergies in particular are a serious health problem. Anaphylaxis, which is what happens when the airways swell in response to the allergen, are life-threatening. There's sort of 8 major food allergens that create the most serious reactions. In the U.S., every 3 minutes, somebody goes to the emergency room with a food allergy. And cumulatively, that's like 32 million people in the U.S. that have allergies. And teens and young adults are at the highest risk for dying from anaphylaxis. How does that happen? So this is back to that other isotype, class switch, IgE. Remember, we talked about that one being something that is involved in protecting against parasites, but it's also involved in allergies. So if you're exposed to something like, let's say, peanuts, and you have an inappropriate response, and you accidentally make IgE antibodies because your body confuses the peanut with a worm, you're making then IgE antibodies that will bind to the peanut. Some of those IgE antibodies will go bind on what are called mast cells, that's part of the immune system, and they'll sit there, and if they're exposed again to peanut, they'll cause the mast cell to react If you got the antibodies and the allergen comes, then the mast cell releases a bunch of histamines. That causes inflammation, anaphylaxis, and so forth. And that's a really bad thing. So this is why that IgE isotype is a very potentially dangerous one. In the developed world, most of us are not at risk for parasites. And so the protective benefits are sort of limited. But this ends up being a very hazardous aspect of it. And so we began trying to study those cells. And the IgE-producing B cells are so rare in humans that they'd never been purified before. So using some of the single-cell transcriptomic techniques that I talked about in the first lecture, we set about to try to find those cells, sequence their transcriptomes, understand their biology. And so in collaboration with Kari Nadal, I'll show a picture in a minute, my student who's an allergy specialist, formerly at Stanford, now at Harvard, my student Derek Kroot was able to work with her to get blood samples from kids who had food allergies. We'd sort out to enrich for B cells and then do single cell sequencing where we could look at the gene expression. And from that, we could assemble the sequences of the antibodies for each of those B cells from which we could synthesize the genes and have the antibodies produced in vitro so we could study their chemical properties. And in doing so, we discovered quite a bit about the B cells that make IgE antibodies, and I'm not going to dwell on that, but there's sort of naive cells and plasmablasts, which are the ones that are producing the most antibody. These are the ones that remember the antibody, these are the ones who make a lot of antibody. We looked at the various gene expression, we looked at number of cells from all the various isotypes here, began to analyze the ones that were IgE and that were peanut specific. Because we had made the protein, we could see what they bind, we knew which ones would bind peanut. In these peanut allergic individuals, and roughly half of them did. I mean, it was like, that's all that's going on in IgE, is making allergy-related proteins. This is Derek, this is Kari. So this is now a graph like the ones I've shown before of lineages, clonal families, colored by isotype, most of them IgE, you can see here. The shape here is the identity of the individual patient that gave the blood. And what you see here in clonal family one is two different shapes that have made the same antibody sequence. So two different people that have made the same antibody is convergent evolution. Amazing. And when you look at those sequences very closely, you see that they're very similar, a few differences there. They're highly mutated. This is not like just due to random chance. These antibodies are at the tail end of the distribution on mutation frequencies of everything we looked at in this study. So highly non-random by any statistic you'd like. And we found that as we did the biochemical characterization of the antibodies, we could do all kinds of tinkering and engineering of the antibodies. We could swap out heavy and light chains. We could take out the mutations. We could revert them to their sort of naive sequence and so forth. And that, for the most part, this is the naturally occurring one right here for this particular antibody. For the most part, these are two different peanut antigens, and these are the two most important, and these are the binding constants. So being up in this corner is good because it means a strong binder. The original antibody is here, very strong for error H2, okay for error H3. As we started changing things, most of them reduced the binding. If we go back to the naive unmutated sequences, and we took out the hypermutation, you destroy the binding largely. It gets orders of magnitude smaller. There was one switch we were able to make that actually increased the binding to error H3 while only modestly decreasing the error H2. That's sort of an interesting engineering thing to done to make something that binds to both equally. And so with all this tinkering with the antibodies and sort of a genetic engineering of them, we began to wonder if this didn't present a route to maybe cure food allergies in a way that hadn't been done before. And the idea was the following. If we took one of these disease-causing IgE antibodies and we combined it with a benign IgG antibody, which doesn't bind to the mast cells and doesn't release histamine, and we had the sort of variable region that could bind to peanuts, we kept that, and we swapped in the constant region that does not bind to the mast cell and created this sort of engineered antibody, and we gave it to people as an injection, it would compete with the bad antibodies that cause the disease. And maybe you could do it at enough levels that it would outcompete. It would, this person, if they ate peanut, these antibodies would bind. There'd be no allergic reaction, and there'd be no peanut left to get to the IgE on the mast cells. That was kind of the theory that we had. And we decided to pursue that. We started a company together, the three of us, and we just started to do this sort of experimentation at scale. We began to march through many other foods, and we recruited a lot of patients who were allergic to these things, peanuts, shellfish, egg, milk, soy, wheat, tree nuts, so forth. There's non-food things as well. I'm not going to talk about them today. But we assembled a vast collection of essentially fully humanized antibodies, something like 10,000 antibody sequences that are specific to all these allergens, and discovered many interesting things along the way. Here's some that are cross-reactive across multiple nuts. So each of these different antibodies, these three all react both with, they bind to cashew and pistachio. This one over here binds to hazelnut, macadamia, walnut, pecan, all in a single antibody. And, you know, begin to work out all these properties and had a very nice catalog. We went deep into peanut, here is now the same sort of picture of the clonal families that I showed before, but now with not just a handful, with 3,000 different antibodies across many different individual patients. And if you take this cluster and zoom in, you can see again highly convergent evolution. Here each color is a different individual, and it's just many people have evolved this sequence. And turns out this is a very good binder to the major peanut allergen. Okay, so we then began making the IgG version of this tested it in mice, and it actually worked amazingly well. So the way the mouse model for food allergies works is that it doesn't go in anaphylaxis, but its temperature changes. So if the allergic response is marked by a reduction in temperature. So if you have the mouse that's not been sensitized to peanut allergies, its temperature doesn't change when it's given peanut. But if you've made it allergic and you give it peanut, the temperature drops quite a bit. Now, if you start giving it our antibodies, there's actually three binding sites together in this. But as you increase the dose, you see that you return to almost the non-allergic state after a certain point. And so indeed, as we'd hoped, you can administer this antibody like a prophylactic vaccine, and it provides protection against allergic response in rodents. How about in people? So let me share a little news story. That's underway.
Almost 3 in 100 Australian children have a peanut allergy. And while oral immunotherapy can gradually desensitize patients, the process can take years. Now, a world-first antibody therapy being trialled here in Australia has the potential to offer year-long protection from severe reactions with just a few injections.
Kessia Bowen was just 3 years old when she had her first serious reaction to peanuts.
My parents just watched my face blow up immediately and then took me straight to the hospital.
The 26-year-old has spent her whole life avoiding the pantry staple, knowing in severe cases it can be life-threatening.
It just can happen in a matter of seconds. It's quite scary.
Now a world-first clinical trial here in Australia could potentially stamp out dangerous reactions. A severe peanut allergy occurs when the body's immune system mistakes peanuts for something harmful like a virus and produces a flood of chemicals or bad antibodies. This new therapy re-engineers those bad antibodies, converting them into allergy blockers, which when injected can potentially protect the patient from future allergic reactions.
Kind of acts like a heat-seeking missile to latch on to peanut very tightly and not let that peanut go on to cause an allergic reaction.
The trial, to commence next week nationwide, will run over 3 months and is calling on people aged 15 to 55 with a clinically diagnosed severe peanut allergy. With just 4 injections, they're hoping to provide coverage for a whole year.
This is a blocking drug, so it should work straight off the bat.
If the trial is a success, then the sky really is the limit for this therapy. They're already looking at using the same science on patients with other allergies, starting with shellfish.
Sophie Walsh, Nine News.
So it's been super exciting to see this work translated from sort of basic science into actually human trials. We'll see if it works. They've just finished recruiting their last patient for the trial, and in the next few months, we're going to get an answer about whether this actually is something that can help individual humans. It's very exciting. Well, the last thing I want to talk about for the next just couple minutes is coming back to where are the B cells in the body? And remember, we started with fish because we could get the B cells no matter where they were and which tissues. And in humans, we were sort of limited in our ability to draw blood, and so we're only getting the B cells from the blood. But that represents only a small fraction of where the B cells are throughout one's body. This is a lovely figure from a recent paper, which has kind of mapped it out where all the B cells go and all the other immune cells go in the body. And blood is a small fraction of everything. Bone marrow is a giant piece. Lymph nodes, another giant piece. But they're also found in the skin, in the lungs, in the liver, in the gastrointestinal tract. We have immune cells throughout all our organs. And it's sort of hard to sample that in humans. I'm going to say, but we actually have been able to do, for a few cases, work with organ donors and obtain tissue, not just the blood, but also bone marrow, lymph, and spleen, to characterize the B cells in those tissues, all from the same individual. Sort of a unique opportunity. This builds on the work on the Tabula Sapiens Human Cell Atlas that I discussed in an earlier lecture. And Ivana Svevich and Mike Swift in the lab did this work. And so we had donors with each of these four tissues, did the single cell gene expression. From that, we're able to get the full antibody sequence, as well as the cell type and cell state from his gene expression. We could build these trees and connect them now not just with isotypes, but with the cell type as well. Which sort of subflavor of B cell was it? And so here we had six donors, four of which we got it from all four tissues, two tissues, one from three tissues. And this was a huge number of cells, and sort of like compared to other, it's probably as big as the next biggest immune cell atlas ever done, with over a million cells, with all the gene expression as well as the antibody sequence. And what we found was many of the lineages are restricted to a single tissue and are not found in other tissues. So if you're just looking at blood, you're going to be missing a bunch of what's there. Others were shared between tissues. So color code here is the tissue. You can see this lineage has members represented in different tissues. This one, only one. Some really large spread across the whole thing. And it's we did the little calculation of, is it random? Is the distribution of cells random across the tissues? If it was well mixed, you'd expect this sort of fraction to have no membership in other tissues. Is actually much higher. So clearly, there's something deliberate going on and something with the program process. You can do this not just with single examples of lineages, but look at the statistics across the whole thing, and it's consistent across individual donors. I think that's the take-home message here, is that these number statistics distributions are consistent from individual to individual, just as we saw in the fish. Right. Again, there, the individual uses of VDJ were idiosyncratic, but the overall statistics were comparable, and we see that here. We can look at where is all the mutation happening, in which cells and in which parts of the body. And it turns out the bone marrow is the place where the most mutation is happening. And so that's the place where evolution is at its sort of most intense. You know, we see it in the blood, but the levels are much lower. So again, one has to be, I think, always cognizant of how one is sampling the body and how that affects one's conclusions. The last sort of data slide here I'll leave you with is we've been able to use this, and knowing not just the lineage information and kind of the mutational density, but also sort of the cell type, the cell subtype, cell state. These are ASC, stands for antibody secreting cell types, and there's different flavors. We've been able to build models about you know, how their dynamics are moving around and how they leave the germinal center, which is where a lot of the feedback happens to refine the antibodies. And one question is, do they leave at a constant rate, or do they leave at preferential rates for different cell types? This is sort of the prediction for constant rates. This is the data, which is in pretty good agreement. And again, we're able to sort of use this sort of repertoire-wide very quantitative information to be able to test models of antibody formation, cell type variation, and migration within the body. So with that, I will wrap up and just sort of summarize by saying this connection between the immune system and evolution has been amazingly productive. And by doing deep sequencing of the antibody repertoire, we've been able to quantitatively understand the evolutionary landscape of the adaptive immune system in many different ways, including measuring the rates of antibody class switching, discovering this phenomenon of correlated switching, measuring the strength of selection pressure after vaccination, using convergent evolution as a tool to find potential cures for food allergies, and to probe the reservoirs of B cells throughout the body and understand the landscape of antibody secreting cells. And I did not start my career as an immunologist. I got into it about a decade ago. And this quote from Caesar Milstein about it seemed very simple from the beginning. And fortunately, being ignorant of the complexity and not realizing how naive you are was a good thing, because maybe one would not have gotten into it appreciating just how complex the immune system is and how much is going on there. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.